use a trainer, nutritionist, surgery, or pills. People asked me, "What did you do?" I usually kept it short and replied, "I changed what I ate and exercised more." Over time, I felt more and more uncomfortable with that answer because it wasn't true. The right answer was, I took myself seriously. I said no to people. I got the junk out of my house. I learned to walk away from half-full plates and bad situations. I made some painful decisions regarding my marriage. And I took risks. And because of that, I took care of myself and subsequently lost weight. Most important, I finally listened to myself and lived life in accordance with my spider senses. This is not about avoiding soda or doing 300 abdominal crunches every morning or eliminating carbohydrates from your diet. This is not about eating lean fish and avoiding certain kinds of meats and always ordering sauce on the side. These things may help, but these things alone will not bring you to a place of health. They are the battle, but they are absolutely not the war. In some ways, this is about hope, about envisioning a future, and not being afraid of failing, but being afraid of not trying. For every meal that you make some bad choices, there are some where you make good ones. Be kind to yourself and see how right you are able to get it. When I looked at the evidence from the field of psychology, medicine, nutrition, and exercise physiology, the answer was simple. Weight management is about something much bigger than what you eat for breakfast. But why and how you eat speaks volumes about how you live your life. There is no greater metaphor for how we regulate ourselves in every aspect of our lives than eating, partly because we do it multiple times a day. Eating is an example of how we are able to listen to ourselves, or not, and how much we are able to weigh what we need and want against the voices of stakeholders, fears, and the golden rules of our youth. Our eating habits give us powerful insight into our living habits. Food is the first place we learn self-regulation. We learn to stop eating when we are full, to choose healthy options, to slow down in the face of goodies, and to learn how to treat ourselves and respect our bodies. Think about how much and how often we eat at the behest of others. We eat because they say it is time to eat. We eat what they want us to eat. We eat to please them. We eat as much as they want us to eat. Or we struggle with food because we want to look a certain way for others. Eating is clearly a behavior that is about our bodies and our minds, and yet so much of the time we do it in the service of others. And most troublesome, we find it difficult to walk away from a half-full plate of food, even when we are done. Life's other plates. Our eating patterns tend to mirror our behavior in other areas of our lives, such as love, work, and money. We are told to blindly follow rules when it comes to food, such as eat what is on your plate, eat to please, even if other people give you what you don't want, finish it up. Even if you initially chose badly or put too much on your plate, tough luck, finish up. Now, what if we substituted eat with love, money, and work? What if we said, love the way others want you to love? Spend to please others. Stick it out even if it's not working, even if you initially didn't choose well. That doesn't feel good, does it? Few of us are genuinely socialized to listen to ourselves, which is an elegant balance of analyzing the data, integrating it, and then listening. It also means hearing what our stakeholders have to say, but then still honoring ourselves. We have to face down the fear, too. Keep in mind that fear is often what knits tribes of stakeholders together, And we erroneously believe that if one person does what feels right, then anarchy may break out. We have been so programmed to march to the call of others, to listen to others, that not only do we not know how to eat, but we are also losing sight of how to live. Ultimately, when you take responsibility and ownership, whether at the dinner table, in the bedroom, or at work, you are taking a risk. It is a risk because if you fail, it's your fault. I am always amazed at how awful a feeling it is for people, even when they trust their guts, to have to take responsibility. Let's draw a specific parallel here. Just like you did in Chapter 8, I want you to think about some of the reasons why you eat. To avoid bad feelings. To give yourself a reward. To fill the emptiness. To manage frustration, loneliness, anger, fear, boredom, because the world tells you to eat. Now, think about some of the reasons you have been, or perhaps currently are, in a bad relationship. Are you finding any similarities? To avoid being alone. To give yourself a reward from the outside. To fill an emptiness. To manage loneliness. Because you are afraid to be alone. Boredom. Because the world tells you to. Are those also the reasons you may spend money the way you do? Or stay in a job you don't like? It is a house of cards. By denying our spider senses, we can maintain the illusion. It's why we often take stock and find ourselves at an unhealthy weight and unhappy in many other things. Remember, fear, stakeholders, and golden rules are loud, and spider senses do not tend to operate in just one area. Once you unleash them and listen to them, you might start shifting your role in a relationship after you lose weight, or you may start questioning your job, or you may start approaching many other things in your life differently. Once you stop living blindly in one province, you will stop living blindly in all of them. Spider senses don't know walls. In the next few chapters, we are going to take the central tenets of this book, our spider senses, our stakeholders, our fears, and our golden rules, and apply them to gatekeeping and walking away in our relationships, our jobs, and our lives in general. You will start to see that your compulsion to blindly finish everything on your plate may in fact be a glimpse into why you are sticking out a broken relationship, a broken job, and a broken life. Once you are courageous enough to walk away from that second helping, you may become strong enough to walk away from other things too. Believe it or not, that clean plate may be about more than just your weight. The next few chapters examine how society wants us to fit a certain role, and this book is about breaking out of that role and those scripts. I don't think the fact that we find ourselves in an epidemic of obesity is very surprising. After all, our society as a whole is invested in everyone following a party line, whether it's eating, loving, spending, working, or living. You can break your habits. But first, it requires that you be willing to break with society. Chapter 13. Love and Relationships. When do you hold and when do you fold? In art, as in love, instinct is enough. Anatole France. A popular relationship weight loss myth in our culture sounds like this. Oh, look, she lost the weight and got a divorce, and now that she's skinny, she is trading up, getting rid of him, thinks she is better than him. This is a childish take on a complex situation. Making the commitment to lose weight and successfully achieving that goal means taking on lots of changes, both large and small. It means valuing oneself enough to actually become healthier. It means saying no to unhealthy options. It means making time for exercise. And all of this means less time for something or someone else. Mounting a successful weight loss effort means learning to advocate for yourself. It means listening to yourself. And that is bound to segue into the rest of life. Learning to walk away from a second helping may very well translate into clearer communication within relationships and standing up for yourself. That could result in a stronger, healthier relationship, or it could result in needing to walk away from something that is no longer nourishing. By listening to your spider senses, knowing when you are full, and knowing when to walk away from the plate, you start learning to trust your spider senses in all areas of your relationships. You may trust your spider senses and ask for something you need, or address something that makes you uncomfortable, rather than numbing those feelings. The pattern of losing weight and ending relationships is often simplified into a scenario where the person who lost weight now looks good and is on the prowl. The more likely scenario is that sustained and healthy weight loss may require the person to learn to take care of him or herself, and the day-after-day process of feeding a body with healthy food, making better choices, and advocating for oneself at the table may translate into greater advocacy in a relationship and a better ability to communicate needs and recognize wants. It is also likely that a successful weight loss process, characterized by listening to spider senses, opens up those spider senses everywhere in the person's life, including his or her relationships. Like food, relationships are a primitive place. Many of our lessons were learned early on by watching our parents and taking cues from the world around us. We are in many ways wired to make the same mistakes over and over again, and much of this is due to our inability to heed our spider senses. Think about most of the bad relationships you have had. You can almost trace back to the moment in time when you knew it was wrong, but the voices around you, the golden rules, and the fears within you told you to stick it out. Relationships also become a tricky balancing act. They require treading that fine line of spider senses and good sense in order to make the right decision. Ironically, most people enter marriage far more frivolously than a mortgage. At least a mortgage has a finite end. And the legal and financial entanglements of a marriage reach far more deeply. At the end of the day, the main lesson we are taught about relationships is that the only successful way for a marriage to end is if one of the parties dies. Till death do us part. If someone leaves voluntarily, then it gets chalked up to failure. People get congratulated on the longevity of their relationships, but rarely are they asked, has it been a happy 20 years? Why is divorce deemed a failure rather than simply an end? By and large, when we eat badly, we are treating ourselves badly. Many times I have watched someone eat an excessive meal in the name of treating themselves. The fact is, many people do not know how to treat themselves and are experts at putting themselves down. In fact, if most of us were in a relationship with ourselves, we should break up with us, given how badly we treat ourselves. So, if we are treating ourselves badly through food, it makes sense to stay in a relationship that is not working. Why would we value ourselves in that space either? Preserve at all costs? We are caught in a cult of preserve the relationship at any cost. What is unfortunate is that so many people are poor gatekeepers at the time they choose a life partner. Maybe they are young or still haven't figured out who they are and what they want. Many times we choose partners, particularly those we choose earlier in life, on the basis of what we know, and that is generally the party line fed to us by our families and our communities. We tend to choose people who look like us, work like us, are educated like us, and who make good prospects. Good prospects are typically defined by society, money, ambition, vocation, and demographic characteristics. Rarely does authenticity climb too high on that list. People will look askance at the woman committed to the genuine, authentic, albeit moneyless, artist, but they will often jump into reveries of celebration for those who may choose an unkind, albeit wealthy, financier. Our spider senses can be all but silenced in the relationship realm when we are faced with our stakeholders. So, while we might make a bad choice, we're often forced into that feeling of being stuck with it. We all make bad choices. We shouldn't have to pay for them forever. Stakeholders and love. Even more than at the dinner table, stakeholders exert an incredibly powerful influence on us in relationships. They set the tone for us early on for what we should expect, and we learn from watching their relationships. They voice approval and disapproval. So not only can they significantly impact gatekeeping, but they are also critical in keeping us in unhealthy relationships, even after our spider senses do kick in. Even when our spider senses are screaming, "Get out!" our stakeholders are saying, "Stay in!" I talk to dozens of people about their dating lives, courtships, relationships, marriages, and divorces in preparing this book. One theme that was surprisingly common was ambivalence at the altar, or even earlier in the relationship. Many of these people basically shared that they knew, at the spider sense level, that it was not the right fit, but they assumed that with time, it would grow to be right. In almost all cases, that person looked good on paper. He or she had the right job, the right family, and it was the right time to get hitched. Some of these marriages and relationships are still intact, but some have ended. Gatekeeping and love. Timing is everything, they say. In life, opportunities are often presented to us at times when we cannot avail ourselves of them. For example, children make a move for a promising new job more difficult. You meet a wonderful potential partner, but are already in a relationship. The same thing happens with food. We eat lunch and then get to work, and a lunch buffet is set out. The big dinner falls on the day we feel sick. We start a healthier food regimen, and the new administrative assistant brings donuts in every morning. Gatekeeping and spider senses are critical in navigating the tricky waters of timing and opportunities. Obviously, when we meet that right person at the right time, that's a good thing. Often, such people reflect on their good luck or the fact that they constructed the opportunity. For example, they were actively dating, attending social functions, or going to online dating sites. Spider senses operate to tell us this is the right person, and gatekeeping operates for us to let them in. And it works. Keep in mind, too, that if you are listening to your spider senses, then you are likely taking care of yourself in other areas of your life. For example, eating well, exercising, and are more willing to put yourself out in the world. Many people who struggle with weight or body image issues will report that they don't feel ready to put themselves out there. Often, when working with a client who is struggling with both weight and relationship issues, we focus on unearthing those spider senses and reminding her to take care of herself so that she will be positioned to engage in some good relationship gatekeeping. Spider senses become essential when you face bad timing and the right person. This can become a morally sticky issue. Can a married person leave a shaky marriage because they find a better partner? What about someone who is engaged? Just a boyfriend? Doesn't that mean every relationship is hanging in a state of suspended animation, waiting for a better person to poach one of the partners away? I would argue no. In a committed, connected, and authentic relationship, the parties are invested in each other. The connection is powerful. Both are growing and secure. And even if a bevy of beauties or other engaging new opportunities are paraded in front of either person, the investment in the relationship and the authentic connection implies that such temptations will not result in either of them running away. By and large, I see the darker relationship failures, such as infidelity, occur when there is a certain lack of authenticity operating, such as relationships glued together by obligation, stakeholders, fears, or golden rules. And don't get me wrong, those glues are mighty strong, but they are also false. And as a result, the behavior of the parties within the relationship starts drifting to an inauthentic place, because the people in the relationship are unable to walk away from a dirty plate. It's a bit like the person who keeps eating even though he is full, because he doesn't want to deal with the other things that need to be managed in his life. Where it gets tricky is when the marriage or relationship is not working, and the person is fighting to keep it intact, throwing bad money after good, staying at the table, cleaning the plate. It is at this nexus that we see infidelity, dubious conduct on the internet, and a fantasy life that starts to encroach on real life. It takes courage to sift through the wreckage, to see if it can be fixed, have the painful but necessary conversations, but then walk away when it is broken, just like you'd walk away from a plate that still has some food on it when you are full. Ask anyone who has walked away, and they'll tell you that divorce or a breakup of a long-term relationship was one of the most difficult decisions they ever had to make. But there are times when the person in that broken relationship realizes that they would be healthier out of that partnership. Obviously, the best course of action is when the married person works with his or her partner to either remediate the relationship or disassemble it. At such times, spider senses become critical, and it can be tricky business with the overpowering din of stakeholders, the intoxicating mythology of fairy tales that reinforce people for sticking it out, and the fear of being alone and leaving the safe, known, yet broken place for the unknown. It comes back to what we already discussed about positive and negative reinforcement. Staying in a relationship may work from the position of negative reinforcement because by staying or by getting into a relationship, whether you want it or not, you get other people off your back. So, when you stick around or you get into a relationship, it's easier than dealing with the criticism and disillusionment and fears. Many people I have talked to have said, "I got a boyfriend to shut my mother up." Here's a situation in which people get into hot water in the first place. The time is right. Your friends are all getting married or in relationships. You finally have the right job, and now you want the right partner. Your biological clock is ticking, and so you take the most reasonable option that presents itself at that time. Many people have ignored their spider senses and made the classical gatekeeping error, thinking, if I don't marry this one, another one might never come along. Fear feeds into the bad pick. Fear about being alone. Fear about missing the boat. Fear of failing to please stakeholders. Or fear of failing to meet a societal script. It's easy to walk away from the wrong person at the wrong time. If it's not the right fit, you are not noticing anyone. And if you meet someone who is clearly not a good fit in any way, it's even easier to say goodbye. Interestingly, most people use relationship counseling, marriage counseling, couples counseling, etc., at the wrong time. Typically, people turn to a counselor once the whole system starts falling apart, and by then, it is often too late. My professional advice is to seek out the services of a licensed mental health practitioner with expertise in relationship counseling before you sign on the dotted line or make a more permanent commitment. It is a chance to use an important data source at the time of gatekeeping and get training in communication, listening, support, and opening up about vulnerabilities within your relationship. Instead of using counseling as a place of dismantling, it is actually a wonderful place to gatekeep and strengthen your relationship at the front end. Fear and love. There is a song lyric from a popular song that goes something like, "Fear is the heart of love." It's sad and cynical, but unfortunately, we have allowed it to become true. I see more fear in relationships than in any other arena in which I work. Fear of getting hurt. Fear of being rejected. Fear of being alone. Fear of dying. Fear of change. Fear of never having a child. Fear of what others will think. Fear of letting down your family. Or fear of letting down your children. Fear is the most powerful adhesive we have. Fear unites, because if two people are afraid, then even as the authentic ties that may have once bound them disappear, the fear ties are as sticky as a spider's web. I am amazed at how many relationships are cemented by fear rather than connection. Interestingly, with many people I know who struggle with food and walking away, one of the fears is, when will I get to eat again? So we often eat more than we should, in fear of not having enough. Perhaps we stay in relationships longer than we should for a similar reason, the fear of not having enough love, attention, or affiliation. We have talked about fear and how it fools with spider senses. The fears are not rational. The most classical fears all emanate from the relationship space. Freud wisely said about love, "We are never so defenseless against suffering as when we love." And these fears are fires that get their oxygen from our stakeholders, who fill us with fears of shame or reinforce our existing fears and keep the fire going. And because so many people around us are living in relationships that may need to be dismantled or at least reconfigured, you can find yourself in a tribe where everyone has drunk the Kool-Aid and no one is heeding their spider senses. I find it fascinating that 54% of Americans will eat until their plates are empty. It's a similar statistic for the divorce rate in the United States. Maybe the dirty platers are the ones who are leaving relationships. When I look at the people I have talked to who have taken bold stances in their relationships and walked away, they noticed that the stakeholders who often most distance themselves from their situation were those who were in questionable relationships. Simply the action of that person walking away was a bit more of a wake-up call than the stakeholders were able to tolerate. So, instead of facing what may have been going on in their own lives, they did what most relationship ostriches do. They stuck their heads in the sand. The classic fear is, if I communicate my needs and he doesn't like it, he will leave me. If he would leave you for communicating your needs, what kind of life is that setting up for you? If your partner cannot hear your dreams, your hopes, your needs, your wants, and your concerns, and would leave if you voiced them, why would you want to keep that relationship? This is most likely a tone that is set early in the relationship. I recently spoke with a woman who was going through a divorce after 14 years of marriage. Her husband was a wealthy man with a successful medical practice. They had two children. When they initially came together, she had a successful career, and he encouraged her to leave it. He said he would take care of her, and they were going to have kids, so why work? She told me about the detritus of their relationship: infidelities, strippers, sex workers, and insults. And the very guy who had encouraged her to leave her career was now criticizing her for spending but not earning. She talked about how narcissistic he was, and he was, always putting his needs above the needs of everyone else. I then asked her if this was really a change, or if he'd been like that when she met him. She confessed that he had always been like that. But the game was different 15 years ago when they were courting. He was considered a good catch. Her friends were getting married. She wanted kids. He was rich. He said he would take care of her. And so the narcissism seemed like a nagging fly, even though she did acknowledge that it hadn't sat well with her at the time. Spider senses. She went ahead and assumed it would just work itself out. It didn't. It rarely does. The person you meet is who they have always been at a fundamental and core level. He didn't change, but being in the presence of his entitlement for so long wore on her. She never tried to talk to him about her concerns early on. After all, her mother had told her how lucky she was to have him. Her married friends enjoyed spending time with them. And even as her spider senses kept telling her to get out, she fought to stay in, until she was faced with a mountain of evidence that he had been repeatedly having sexual relationships outside of the marriage. It was consistent with his behavior from day one. If she had communicated her needs early on and he had left her, wouldn't she have been better off? The relationship bait and switch. This is a situation where gatekeeping, stakeholders, and fairy tales often come together in a dreadful collision that can set the tone for long-term dishonest and inauthentic relationships. You know about the bait and switch. For example, you go to a car dealership advertising the make and model of a car you want for $12,000, just at the top of your budget. But when you get there, you find out the car lacks features you thought it would have, and by the time the correct car is offered to you, it now costs $5,000 more. The bait was the low price that got you into the dealership, and then the salesperson got you to pay the higher price because you were hooked and in the mindset of wanting to buy a car. Such a maneuver can leave you feeling tricked. Relationships are the same. Often when we meet new people, they get the best version of us. A well-put-together, great conversationalist, upbeat version. Many times in life, we hit periods where we want to be in a relationship. We think it's time to get married. Our parents are pressuring us. We are afraid to be alone. We want someone to take trips with. At those times, if we find a potential partner in whom we may be interested, we might say and do things that are not really what we are all about. In essence, we defy our spider senses. For example, we may say we want kids when we don't, or that we love football when we don't, or that we like certain foods that we don't. We often create a different version of ourselves to first bait and then hook the other person. And once we feel secure in the relationship, we come clean. And the baby-loving, football-loving carnivore you presented yourself to be turns out to be someone quite different. Or worse, you hold back on communicating needs or wants for fear of losing the person, and then find yourself years into a relationship where you still cannot communicate about what you need or want. Many times we do the bait and switch for reasons of fear, fantasy, or pressure from the outside world. Word to the wise. Let the used car dealers keep the bait and switch. Relationships are no place for denying spider senses and turning yourself into someone you're not. It's simply not sustainable. The Golden Rules and Love. Cinderella worked hard, was obedient, found mice to make her clothes, played hard to get, lost a shoe, found a prince, and lived happily ever after. We were raised on this nonsense, girls in particular, the stuff that reinforced gender roles, assured us we would be rescued and that relationships were safe. We also learned the golden rules about listening to our parents, not wasting stuff, and honoring vows, even if they were made from an uninformed space. What's interesting to me is that if a person were in a job that did not pay well, was going nowhere, and was causing distress, and then that person found a new job that paid better, we would not criticize him or her for making that shift. If a person is in a relationship or marriage that is not fulfilling or healthy, going nowhere, causing distress, and that person found an alternative mate who treated her better and left, many would call her a selfish bitch for making that shift. Weddings and the surplus meaning of relationships can definitely scramble spider senses. What is it about vows made in a white dress that are so much more compelling than other sorts of promises? I am a huge proponent of renewable vows that require revisiting, recrafting, and reconsidering every 5 years. I am also a serious supporter of vows to oneself, because if you can't adhere to your promises to yourself, are you really going to be able to love, honor, and cherish another? This requires growth rather than complacence or blind allegiance, and it requires the parties to stay in touch with their spider senses. The good thing about staying in touch with spider senses within a relationship is that it forces you to communicate with your partner, honor yourself, and take care of yourself. If there is one huge risk for people in relationships, it's that they outsource their needs. So much of our relationship fantasy in this culture centers around being rescued. In outsourcing our needs and waiting to be rescued, the fairy tales of youth start looming large, and any time we outsource, our spider senses lose their edge. Spider senses make you better in a relationship from the outset, because instead of letting sleeping dogs lie, you actually address problems as they arise because things don't feel right. Instead of letting a situation fester to the point of no return, you take it on at the time and insert growth rather than disease into a relationship. However, communicating clearly means facing fears, and that is a tough pill for people to swallow. But isn't it all about the wedding? Ah, the wedding. Contributor to gatekeeping errors on the biggest decision you can make in a life. The wedding is the ultimate scrambler of our good judgment and our spider senses, and it impairs our gatekeeping big time. I love love. Everyone loves love, and everyone loves a party. I don't think a lifelong legal commitment should be made just for the sake of having a party. The wedding is the best example of a gatekeeping mistake with permanent ramifications. Let's face it, love in the beginning, 4 to 18 months into a relationship, depending on the couple, is all good. It's all dopamine. Every time you see this person, it's like doing a line of cocaine or eating fudge. The same brain areas light up. You are bright, shiny, beautiful, and it's wonderful. It makes sense that you would want to celebrate it with your friends. It could be the ultimate gatekeeping error. Don't legally link yourself to someone just so you can have a big party, look pretty, and have your friends celebrate with you. Remember, too, sometimes one thing leads to another and you get swept up in saying yes to a proposal and yes to getting married, when you really knew on your second date with this person that it was a bad fit and that you should have walked away. It gets more and more difficult to get up and walk away once the hall is booked, The dress is purchased, and the invites are in the mail. So you have to gatekeep early and tap into your spider senses, because once the food is on the plate, or the wedding train has left the station, canceling is much more difficult. Basically, don't put the cookies on the plate. And if you don't like him, don't go on the second date. The problem with weddings is that they are something we are socialized to dream about, a cultural archetype. Celebrating falling in love is fabulous. It is that most human and lush of experiences. Marriage, however, is legally binding, and it places a regulatory and sometimes religious imprimatur on a relationship. It sets up tax benefits, a way to share assets, and simplifies probate. It's like establishing an LLC or some other corporate structure. It provides protection. Did you throw a formal party the day you signed your car loan? Did you throw a party when you closed on your home? Was your drunken uncle in the room when you went in to sign paperwork that legally bound you to a home? In most cases, people cannot make a lifelong commitment after a month, but they can be in love after a month. The hard work of really mulling over the ramifications of marriage is tough, and such a decision should take place with reason, advisement, and focus. People should consult experts before getting married and always, always return to their spider senses. But in the rush to have a party, all that irritating stuff gets swept aside. I am astonished at the number of people who have confessed that they knew on their wedding day from a spider-sensey place that it didn't feel right. But in the mad dash to avoid disappointing their parents and caterers, the fear of being alone and missing out on the fairy tale wedding, mistakes get made. The wedding is clearly governed by a social order. It's as though without a legal contract we cannot celebrate love. And it speaks to how much our thinking about relationships is colored by the world in which we live. Bad money after good. But love is not money. As Americans, we tend to view relationships like money or an expensive meal, and lots of people will often resist leaving a long-term relationship, saying, "I invested so much time into it. How can I leave?" A relationship is not a bank account or a steak dinner. Yes, you may have accumulated assets and such, but it was simply the process of your life. Stakeholders, fears, and golden rules about how to allocate assets all squirm in the face of someone trying to leave a long relationship, as they may view those 20 years as wasted. I argue the contrary. Such a relationship was a beautiful and important part of your life, and that vision of it can remain if you don't stick it out to the point where it gets rancorous. Relationships, like all human experiences, are transient. They change every day and are meant to be enjoyed in the present. When I hear people say you need to work at a relationship, what that often really means is just seeing through the day-to-day, listening to another person, listening to yourself, not getting stuck on hurts from the past, and not getting lost in what might come. To be in a relationship with someone you respect, care about, and value is a gift. And when you take that in the day-to-day, you honor yourself and your partner each day. Eating is no different in that you can honor yourself at each meal. So much time in relationships is spent hashing the past and arguing about things that haven't happened yet. A relationship cannot be hoarded, just like a meal cannot be prolonged by taking home the leftovers. Some relationships may last 20 minutes, some 20 weeks, some 20 years, and some until you die. There is no prize at the end for sticking it out. The length of a relationship is not an indicator of its success, And perhaps the real measure of success, just like at the table, is the ability to listen to yourself, get the most out of it, and in some cases, walk away before the world thinks you should. Human relationships are not just with the spouse or intimate partner. Relationships are with family members, children, friends, and colleagues. And all of the preceding rules apply. You don't have to stick out any relationship because you feel obligated. You can fix it, or you can walk away from it. You can also learn to consume it differently. But retaining the status quo because of fear, because of golden rules that you didn't write, is like selling yourself down the river. Life is short, and our social connections are one of the most important things in our world. So, shouldn't they be healthy? If you are going to go to the trouble of choosing healthy food for your plate, shouldn't you also choose healthy people for your life? I am confident that as you start making healthier choices at the table, you will make healthier choices in people as well. Few books or experts advocate marital dismantling. We are, in fact, quite obsessed as a culture with keeping them together. Unfortunately, we do not give people in our culture the skills they need to gatekeep and construct good relationships, but we do ask them to keep these broken structures together. I have a problem with not teaching those skills and then demanding that people live with their errors indefinitely and make them work. Relationships and the cloud. Even though we don't really lose our history when a relationship or marriage ends, we do lose our shared custodian of those memories. He may remember the color of the car you rented on your honeymoon. You remember the flavor of the wedding cake. Works out nicely. You don't have to remember all the details because the other person may hold on to different stuff than you. Thus, the end of the relationship means that the shared historian isn't so close anymore, and neither are those memories and factoids. It goes back to the old adage, two heads are better than one. Unfortunately, this sharing of the memory load can lead us to hold on to broken relationships. A committed relationship is like the cloud. It's like sharing information on a network rather than on just one hard drive, and it can be a more efficient use of space. But efficiency can sometimes make us lazy. But what about the kids? Kids are the ultimate stakeholders, and when we split from a spouse or partner, everyone always wonders, what about the kids? I will acknowledge, and this is supported by research, that divorce is hard on children. When I work with patients whose parents are divorced, they will admit that it was a turning point in their lives. My 12-year-old daughter, when asked to write an essay about a difficult experience, wrote about our divorce. That said, there is also significant harm that can come from growing up in a home characterized by discord. Ideally, we make good gatekeeping choices before having kids, but often we don't. And frankly, sometimes we do, even if the marriage ends. My ex-husband is a fantastic father, and while he and I didn't make it, I am tremendously grateful he is their father. I am a firm believer that if you plan on marrying someone and having kids, you should choose a person who will be a good parent. Odds are 50-50 or so that the marriage may end, but they are 100% that the person will always be the child's parent. Choose wisely for the sake of the child who didn't have a say in the matter. Sexy rich guy may seem like an alluring partner, but what happens when it's time for diapers and discipline? Sticking it out for the kids is another example of outsourcing. You get to play martyr, and yet your children are raised in a climate of disconnection that is inauthentic. In the long run, window dressing teaches a set of lessons that may be more destructive than managing the rupture of a family. That said, I know my daughters will always struggle with our divorce, just as they may have struggled with an unhappy home if we had stuck it out. Choose your misery. My work as a mother then becomes remaining respectful of their father, working on our friendship, and retaining my spider senses so I can guide my children well. In order to stay in a relationship that does not work, you need to silence parts of yourself. Sadly, you are likely silencing your spider senses. By silencing your spider senses, you may stay in a broken relationship. Over time, you are reinforced for shutting down those spider senses. Everyone is happy you stuck it out. You don't have to face your fears. You are heeding the golden rule of winners don't quit. But to do so, you had to silence yourself, and this can have damaging consequences. In talking to people in relationships that were pretty awful, I have noticed that they silenced and subsequently lost themselves over time, because if they hadn't, the relationship could not have continued. In the end, they were not feeling self-congratulatory, but rather bitter and resentful. The why. When relationships have outlived their shelf life, people often realize that at some level, they are sticking it out because they once thought, in the light of their divine love, that the other person would change. Sorry for breaking the poetic hope here, but that doesn't happen. People are like rubber bands. They may be able to stretch from time to time and do some amazing things, but in general, they are who they are. If manipulation and machinations on your side get them to behave the way you want, I will set my clock on the fact that they will return to their previous way of behaving, or they will just keep faking it. To be in a relationship with someone who is not really there doesn't make sense. People who aren't cooperating can often feel like a project to us, like something for us to rescue or fix. Rescuing is the province of firefighters and fairy tales, but it's not real life. The stance of sticking it out in hopes of redemption is an old story, and one that has wasted many lives. It's a passive strategy, and one that does not work in life, or at the table. Culture is also a cop-out to me. I recognize this because I lived it. Nice Indian girls don't get divorced. I was even sold a bill of goods that if the eldest daughter does not get married, then, according to the rules of reincarnation, the father will have worse prospects in the next life. Talk about stakeholder pressure. I am amazed at the relativism we use when understanding a construct such as culture. Rules are modified within various cultures as technology and society progresses. For example, people in remote villages learn to use cell phones. But these same villagers will still employ ancient and cruel punishments on girls who won't get married or who leave their marriages. The idea that one has to get married and that one has to stay married in the name of culture is an outsourcing rather than a taking of responsibility for one's authentic life. I know that in Indian culture, in addition to not walking away from relationships, you also don't leave food behind on your plate. This left me fat and unhappy. It may be harder to make certain changes when they are at odds with cultural demands, but that doesn't mean they can't be made. I am tired of ancient and outmoded cultural rules holding people back from fulfilled lives. The bottom line: it's okay to walk away. Nothing bad will happen. Weigh your options, but don't think time will fix an ailing marriage. The fairy tales about sticking it out, the conventional wisdom about persisting, and the ways that stakeholders and fears hurt both our gatekeeping and our spider senses requires courage and facing down old scripts. It's also okay to use data for guidance in how we conduct ourselves in relationships. Obviously, we do care what other people think about our partner, and we may want advice on things like having children, getting a divorce, or sticking it out. As Daniel Gilbert brilliantly opines in Stumbling on Happiness, talk to people who are where you want to be. Want to walk away? Talk to someone who has walked away. But always take all that data and bring it home to your spider senses. Let it breathe, and then you can take on your decisions using both data and your own intuition. The now. The exercise here is tougher, because as a listener of this book, you may be any number of things. Happily in a committed relationship, unhappily in a committed relationship, happily single, or unhappily single. So I would like to give each of these four groups some tasks to take on to ensure that spider senses are being honored in their relationships. Happy in your relationship. This is like a garden that is in bloom, and you always want it to stay that way. Then cultivate it. Ensure that you regularly, yet honestly, share gratitude and positive thoughts and feelings with your partner. We are good at pointing out the things our partners do wrong. Take the time to show him/her that you notice the good stuff. Use I feel statements so you can express feelings and take ownership of them. Make time for the relationship. Just like a garden, you have to weed and water a relationship, and doing that when things are good may give you the tools to manage things during rough patches. Touch base. Practice relationship mindfulness and pay attention. Just like you shouldn't eat mindlessly, you shouldn't relate mindlessly either. Reflect and ensure that it's occurring in other areas as well. Unhappy in your relationship. This is a tough one. This book isn't going to be a palliative for a broken relationship or marriage. If you and your partner are experiencing significant relationship distress, be sure to get counseling with a licensed mental health practitioner. Here are some questions to ask yourself now. What are your spider senses telling you about this relationship? What do you wish was different? What would you keep the same? What are you afraid would happen if you stayed together? What are you afraid would happen if you parted ways? What were you told about relationships when you were a child? What do your stakeholders want, especially your heavy stakeholders? What is the nature of your communication with your partner? Indifferent? Argumentative? Angry, insulting. What did your spider senses tell you at the time of gatekeeping, when you got together? These are great conversations for you to figure out for yourself and may prepare you to start having conversations with each other and with a professional as well. Happy and single. It's a nice place to be. And this is often a wonderful time to really shore up your spider senses, take ownership of your mental and physical health, and enjoy the many other relationships in your life. Reflect on what you were taught about relationships while growing up, and how that has impacted your decision to not be in a committed relationship right now. Consider how you might react if you did meet someone interesting. Reflect on how fears, golden rules, and stakeholders would factor into your thinking and gatekeeping. You may be committed to being relationship-free for a lifetime. If that's congruent with what you want, then honor that. But by reflecting on these themes now, if things should someday shift for you, you may be in a better position to gatekeep down the road. Unhappy and single. Dating in a modern age is no small task. But with the lessons from this book, You are in a great position to start honoring your spider senses, meeting people, and doing some solid gatekeeping. Just like with diet and exercise, you already know what a healthy relationship looks like. And you probably know about online dating.